Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna, and we'll begin today with local reactions to Afghanistan, where Taliban forces have taken charge of the country, installing themselves in the presidential palace inside the capital city of Kabul. It's a remarkable turn to power for the group, return to power for the group, after being ousted by the U.S. military 2 decades ago. Later this hour, President Biden is expected to deliver remarks on the continuing situation in Afghanistan. He'll do so in the East Room at the White House, and we'll bring you that live here on WBUR when he starts. But first, we want to turn to Faria and Farouk Kohistani. Faria and Farouk's father and brother fled Afghanistan in 1998, and in 2002, the sisters left the country with their mother. Today, they live in Worcester. Welcome, both of you, to Radio Boston.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Thanks for joining us. It's perhaps not the situation in which we would want to have you both on, but here we are, all glued to the news, seeing the scenes of Kabul airport, people trying to flee. How are you both reacting to seeing these scenes out of Afghanistan?
Honestly, it's just pure devastation and heartbreak. Afghanistan has never had the easiest of histories, and truly witnessing, you know, this return to power from this terrorist organization is truly heartbreaking. The same circumstances that we had left under are now returning, and there are people stuck there and facing, you know, the most barbaric of circumstances. And it's really, you know, we feel hopeless and, you know, like, there's not much we can do for, you know, our family back home. So it's a lot of devastation on our end.
You know, we're all remote here. So forgive me. I don't know which of you responded to that answer, but would your sister like to respond as well?
And I just like to echo Fadia's comments there. I think we were all in the hopes that Afghanistan was going to improve over time, because there was still room for a lot of improvement, even in the past 2 decades. But to just see it go in the complete opposite direction is absolutely devastating. And we're just here feeling helpless for our family and other people in Afghanistan right now. So devastation is probably one of the words we can use to describe how we feel right now.
You know, I'm thinking, Fadia, you just graduated last year from Brown, and now you're working, making video games. And Farouk, you graduated from Boston College in 2016, and you're working at a startup. And I guess I'm just wondering, thinking about what a return of the Taliban might mean for women like you in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, we're thinking of just, I can't imagine, you know, education has been such a pivotal aspect of our, you know, refugee status in the United States. And my mother was really hard set on us, you know, getting an education and getting that higher education. So to see the Taliban reinstated in power is absolutely, you know, it's hard to even put into words how horrific it is. It's going to be for women and children, and specifically little girls who have been, you know, working towards their education, who have been trying to get their degrees so that they can begin doing jobs that they're really passionate about. And this is just another aspect of, you know, the barbaric violence that the Taliban will institute as soon as they are, you know, as soon as they're able to.
Yeah, and to add to that, I think it's the idea that for the past 20 years we've been, or 20 years or so, we've been feeding hopes and dreams to young women and young girls in Afghanistan that, hey, you too can get an education, you too can do what you want to do in this world and make a difference. Just to take all of that away in a matter of days is absolutely devastating. It's crushing dreams, it's crushing morale, it's basically everything that they have worked for and everything that the people of Afghanistan have worked for is crashing down in front of us. And to see it happen in a matter of days, it just kind of hits the nail in the coffin a little bit more there. So I think what we're feeling, like Fadia said, we can't even put it into words, because there's a certain level of guilt to that as well, that we survived, we're here, we got that education, and we can see what the power of education can do for young women such as ourselves. And then knowing that the people back in Afghanistan no longer have that opportunity or will no longer have that opportunity is heartbreaking.
And I know you're both in the same room, so can I just ask, whenever one of you is speaking, if you could just lean toward the computer, again, remote broadcasting here at WBUR, I appreciate that. So, you know, you talk about the folks back in Afghanistan, and I'm wondering what you're hearing from friends and family. Have you been able to be in touch with them, and what are they telling you?
Yeah, so thankfully we have been able to keep in contact with our family back home, primarily through WhatsApp and just messaging them back and forth. It seems to be kind of a frantic search for, you know, where is right now settling Afghan refugees, where is accepting, where can we go? For the moment, you know, there's nowhere that's really safe in Afghanistan right now. Specifically, you know, in Kabul, where they've instituted more checkpoints and the Taliban have taken over the presidential palace and just all of these things, it seems to be more like a frantic rush to escape and, you know, trying to keep in contact with the news and us trying to, you know, make sure that we're on top of it to see, you know, is Canada accepting, is the U.S. accepting, is Germany, is France, is like, where can we try to help our family so that they can get out?
You know, I mentioned at the top that your parents lived under Taliban rule back in the 90s, and now they're back again. And can I also ask you what you're hearing from your parents? Because I know both of you left at relatively young ages. So what are your parents, what do they have to say about the situation on the ground there now?
I think it's flashbacks to how life was when they were there and flashbacks to what they had to escape from and the trauma that they had to face. And then similar to what I said previously, there's also a level of guilt I can see that my parents are feeling and a level of helplessness that my mom still has her siblings back in Afghanistan and her nieces and nephews. So it's just, it's a lot going on in their mind right now. And again, trying to figure out what we can do to provide additional support to our countrymen and women and also our relatives that are back there. But this sense of knowing that they escaped and others are now facing the same thing, I think it's hurting them even more than it's hurting us. Like you mentioned, we were younger, but they actively had to experience the wrath of the Taliban.
And to echo Fadl's statement, there's a lot of anger and a lot of, you know, justifiable frustration and anger that the U.S. has spent 2 decades in, you know, in Afghanistan and has been unable to, you know, really create a substantial difference. As soon as they evacuated, the country fell within a matter of days. It's, you know, this kind of anger that goes hand in hand with that survival guilt and that, you know, kind of re-experiencing these traumas to know that we're not... Things haven't changed. It's been 2 decades. They've suffered so much. They've sacrificed so much. You know, Afghanistan, the people have been through so much. And it's right back where we started. You know, history has rewound itself.
Yeah, I'm wondering if either of you are worried about even just doing this interview and what that might mean for your family back home and what a new Taliban regime could mean for them.
Yeah, so we are definitely worried about, you know, potential consequences of us speaking. We're very thankful to be in a country where we do have freedom of speech, where we can talk about and criticize, you know, foreign and, you know, our own governments. But we do worry about what the consequences will be of us speaking here. But we felt that it was important to talk about in something that, you know, something that we can do is raise our voices on our end. As for what a new Taliban rule could look like, I mean, I'm incredibly skeptical. I think it would be incredibly naive to believe anything that they're saying, that, you know, women will be allowed to work and they'll be allowed to get an education. Yeah. Until I see it happening all over Afghanistan, I simply will not believe it. It's 20 years ago, they prevented women and girls from going to school, from working, from leaving the house without a man. And now suddenly they're, you know, kind of peddling this propaganda. And even the peace treaty that was the U.S. signed with the Taliban, they've broken all of those. They've broken most of their, what they said that they were going to do. So there is no reason to believe that under the new Taliban rule, anything will be different than when it was 20 years ago. In fact, it might be even harsher or even, you know, even worse to prevent that kind of rekindling of hope that, you know, happened 20 years ago when the Western troops came and, you know, defeated the Taliban.
Farouk, I think you mentioned earlier about the promises made to the young women and the people of Afghanistan under America's longest-running war. And I'm also aware that we're expecting President Biden to address the nation from the White House later this hour, and we'll bring you that here on WBUR if it happens within the 3 o'clock hour. We'll bring it on Radio Boston. If not, we'll have it on All Things Considered. But I'm wondering what both of you would like to hear from the president on Afghanistan. What would you like him to say and what would you like him to do?
First and foremost, what we're looking for is an acknowledgement of the mistake that was made, this egregious mistake of pulling the troops out and abandoning, you know, a country that had become dependent on the U.S. intervention. 20 years worth of intervention from foreign countries, and the country fell in a matter of days. What was actually happening? How come the Afghan forces weren't trained the way that they were supposed to? Trillions, billions of dollars submitted, all for you know, an unmitigated disaster. And what I would like to see is a promise to either re-intervene the way that they did 20 years ago, or the more likely scenario is to accept Afghan refugees and to expedite their visas and provide them somewhere to live, as they had a hand in the current formation of the conditions.
Final question here for both of you. Are you hopeful about the future of Afghanistan?
And I sigh to that because we've been hopeful for so long. And I think, unfortunately, we're starting to lose hope, I think, along the way. And we're just starting to feel forgotten. I mean, you have the U.S. signing a peace treaty with a terrorist group. And I think we need to emphasize that we signed a peace treaty with a terrorist group and taking them at their word. China is accepting a terrorist group into welcoming them for travel and things like that. Same with Russia. It's just, how can we continue to have hope when the world continues to bring us down and not treat us as people that are being undertaken by terrorist group and being murdered on the streets and getting their rights taken away from them? These are human rights violations that everyone should be taking a hand in and being against. However, we're seeing the opposite of that happen. So I think, although we will continue to be hopeful as it's in our blood as Afghans, it is becoming extremely hard to continue to trust in international systems to help us past the life that we're continuing to live, or I guess not we here, the life that Afghans are continuing to live.
And to echo her statement, beyond just the helplessness that we're feeling, that kind of anger and frustration.
Do you mind leaning forward? Sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you.
Yeah, no worries. I said, beyond what, you know, Farouk's words of kind of this helplessness that we're experiencing and this kind of abandonment that we're feeling from the international community, there is a lot of anger and frustration that can only be withheld for so many years before it kind of bubbles out in a way that is losing hope. You know, we're just so angry and frustrated that Afghanistan has not known peace for 4 decades. And, you know, for the last 20 years, as Farouk was saying, there's been a lot of, you know, improvement in the life, specifically for women's rights. And now, in a matter of days, all that has toppled. How are we supposed to, you know, overcome something
that is that huge, that is essentially, you know, turned back all of that progress in a matter of days? Like, we're literally talking a 2-decade war ended in a matter of days, and the Taliban took over.
Well, Fadia and Farouk Kohistani, I just want to say thank you for joining us this afternoon and sharing your thoughts and the pain and trauma that your family and your countrymen and women are facing. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you for covering this topic as well. We really do appreciate our voices being heard.
Thank you for sharing them. I do want to turn now to another voice on this topic. It's Brian Glynn Williams. He's professor of Islamic history at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. He's the author of 7 books on conflicts in Islamic Eurasia, including The Last Warlord, which is about General Dostum, the Afghan warrior who led U.S. special forces to topple the Taliban regime a generation ago. Professor Williams, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Jamie.
thanks for joining us. And I just want to give you a chance to respond to what you just heard from Sisters Fadia and Farouk Kohestani.
You know, it's so heartwarming to hear that the Kohestani sisters' voices, you know, they're so brave and articulate. And you wish that every woman in Afghanistan had the opportunity they've had. They mentioned that they were filled with devastation and horror. And, you know, I know your listeners are hearing this, but I wanted to forgive me for doing this, give some granularity of detail to exactly what is happening to women in Afghanistan who aren't fortunate enough to escape like they were.
Happening to women today in Afghanistan.
Today, yeah.
Right
today,
now. Go ahead.
Week, month. You know, I met schoolgirls in Afghanistan who were so excited to have reading pads and be in school for the first time, and they're exuberant and sang songs for me. My heart was so warmed. I remember talking to one little schoolgirl who told me about a girl in her village who had been caught by the Taliban in the late 90s, and they found that she had fingernail polish on her fingers. So they dragged her out into the main square and pulled out the villagers, forced them out to watch, and pulled out a sword and cut off her fingers one at a time while chanting from the Quran. This is what the women in Afghanistan are afraid of today. We've already seen that Taliban have broken into villages and kidnapped young girls to be quote-unquote wives. They videotaped themselves flogging women. You know, in the 90s, they put them in chains and stoned them to death for moral crimes. So, you know, I don't see why the Taliban would have changed from then. And I completely agree with the Kohestani sisters when they said, if anything, I bet the Taliban had become more extreme. You know, they used to run a government back in the 90s with a ministry for education or a ministry for borders. Now they have changed under the influence of Al-Qaeda into being a complete terrorist group. The sisters were dead right when they say this group will be a terrorist group taking control of a country. We will have an entire country in Central Asia that is run by a terrorist group that is attached at the hip to Al-Qaeda, the group who did 9/11, and we can expect more terrorism emanating from this country in the future, sadly.
At the same time, Professor, I'm wondering about this idea that President Biden has shared in the past of another year, another 5 years functionally would not make much of a difference on the ground. And so what do you say to that argument?
You know, my response to the argument is this. You know, we've been calling this the longest war in U.S. history, and it was. We've been calling it a 20-year war. That is wrong. The U.S. war effort really wound down in the year 2014. We ended a war called Operation Enduring Freedom back in 2014. And then we began giving the war over to the Afghan National Army. It was then called Operation Resolute Support. So the number of troops went down from 100,000 during the Obama surge in about 2012 down to the 2,500 we had today or a few weeks ago. The small number of U.S. Troops, this very small footprint, was not leading the edge in the war. We weren't taking casualties. We've had less than a dozen killed in action in the last, say, 7 or 8 years. What we were doing was providing logistic support for our Afghan allies. We were flying them in Nighthawk helicopters. We were calling in drone strikes. We were training them, bringing them ammunition, and also giving them moral support. You know, it really helps in this very fragile tribal nation full of quarreling clans and sub-tribes to have the American soldiers there symbolically as a glue and also to show the Afghan tribes and the Taliban that the U.S., the world's greatest superpower, has their back. All we need to do is keep that small footprint of just 2,500 force multipliers or enablers or accelerants in the country there, and they were almost like the finger in the dike, stopping the Taliban from bursting into the country. So as soon as the Trump administration sold them out, you know, pulled them out, they made these plans to pull them out in May, the morale of the Afghan army began to collapse. And of course, it fell apart when they came out last month.
You know, to a lot of Americans, and including folks in the White House, it seemed to be surprising at the speed of that collapse and the speed of the Taliban takeover. Were you surprised at how quickly things fell apart in Afghanistan?
No, I wasn't. And I'm surprised that the Pentagon was. You know, I spent time on a forward operating base in Afghanistan, working for the U.S. Army, doing information operations. And I got to really know the Afghan army very well in that capacity. I also worked in the country for the CIA tracking suicide bombers. And in both of those roles, I got to know the Afghan military forces. And what I found in my experiences was that it wasn't a cohesive modern fighting force, like, say, the U.S. Army. It was this patchwork of quarreling tribal groups. You know, you had Mongol Uzbeks, Shiite Mongol Hazaras, Aryan Pashtuns, Persian Tajiks. All these groups had fought civil wars, and we cobbled them together into one army and trained them to fight for a concept that didn't exist, this overarching concept of a nation. We tried constructing a nation in this land that was almost like Game of Thrones land. You know, it's all full of these cool tribes. And there's a huge culture in this country of tribal defection. We saw over and over again in the last few weeks Afghan army units just surrendering and giving their weapons to Taliban, defections, betrayals. So it didn't surprise me that this army that we built together, you know, to fight the Taliban after we left, fell apart so quickly once the U.S. left, and especially once the U.S. withdrew the one thing that was most focal in the war, that is U.S. air support.
So
over and over again, air support changed the dynamic of the war. As soon as Biden pulled the Apache helicopters out, the bombers, and we stopped supporting the Afghan troops with air support, the whole game changed.
So I do want to ask you, so and given what you're describing in terms of the number of groups and the sort of coalition and holding together this country, the Taliban, again, swiftly toppled that regime. And I'm thinking, can the Taliban effectively rule and govern Afghanistan now? Or are we looking at more conflict with neighbors and other other countries in the region?
Well, you know, the Taliban proved to be very poor leaders when they took over the country, you know, from 94 to 96. You know, these are semi-literate tribal warriors. They don't have any experience in running complex bureaucracies. You know, how are they going to run Kabul International Airport? How are they going to do anything that involves running ministries of education? They did a terrible job in the 90s until we overthrew the government. You know, so I don't see them bringing this country back from the brink. I see them turning it into a harsh, almost medieval religious prison camp. And I see them using their power to crush women horribly, deny them all the rights we've given them, democracy for the people. And also, a key thing people don't understand is the Taliban mainly come from the dominant Aryan Pashtun ethnic group. As soon as they gain control of the country, they will take retaliation against other groups who fought against them, and especially against one small group that's very liberal and very westernized, and that is the Hazaras, a Shiite Mongol group in the mountains. Mm-hmm. We're the last group standing as we speak.
So, Professor, finally, I'm wondering, there's an outside possibility that President Biden is listening to this show right now, but if he were, what would you say to him? What would you like him to do? What would you advise him to do moving forward?
I would say the first most urgent matter at hand is for Biden to organize an air bridge, to fly in all these big Galaxy airplanes and transport planes and fly them into Kabul immediately and start evacuating not just U.S. personnel and U.S. civilians, but everybody who fought for our vision of that country, women's rights activists, Afghan NGO workers, women doctors, of course, all those wonderful Afghans I met and had the honor of serving along in my forward operating base, who fought, and in many cases, 66,000 Afghans died fighting the Taliban. It is of supreme importance that we get those interpreters. Anybody who works for Americans, whether it be a chef on a base, a cook, or a perimeter guard, all of them, their lives are at risk. Already my friends in Afghanistan, who I'm reaching out to and talking to on Facebook, tell me the Taliban are hunting them. I lost two friends on Sunday. So the Taliban are actively hunting anybody who worked alongside Americans. President Biden, please get them all out now. Organize a massive sustained airlift immediately.
Professor Brian Glenn Williams, he's a professor of Islamic history at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. I hope you'll come back and talk to us in the coming days.
It'd be an honor and pleasure. Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you so much for your time.